So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Engadget podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
This week, we're going to talk all about Sundance 2022, the film festival, what we saw, what we liked, what we didn't like, what it means for technology and entertainment, lots of stuff. Devendra, you did an interview with director Joe Hunting of one of the works, and that's coming up at the end of this episode, right?
Yeah, the director of We Met in Virtual Reality, so stay tuned for that chat, too. It's really good.
We're also going to go over some noteworthy news in tech, including Samsung setting the date already for Unpacked 2022. So there's also tech stuff this episode. If you're enjoying the show, please leave us a like on your podcast catcher of choice. Also subscribe and leave us a review, please, on iTunes, because that'll really help people discover us. And if you have the time, usually on Thursday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern thereabouts, we live stream the recording of this podcast on the Engadget YouTube channel. You can talk to us live, have your questions answered. It's a fun time. So come join us if you can. Over the last 2 weeks, Devendra and I, well, week and a half, right? Devendra and I have been checking out, Sundance 2022. This is a film festival that typically takes place in person right after CES in Utah?
Utah.
I've never been in person, Devendra.
Yeah.
So.
Park City. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. But I think for about the last 2 years, it's been, you know, virtual, and there has been great portals set up to facilitate all of this. And one of the big components of this, again, in recent years, is the New Frontier section where they show off their VR, mixed reality, AR projects. What did you think of it this year, Devendra? Because I feel like you definitely have thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, we went through as many projects as we could. And, you know, this is all a new thing for them. So last year was the first time they were like, hey, we're going to build a virtual platform, you know, for people to go in with VR headsets, walk around, see exhibitions, and also like have like a little chat platform to talk with people too. So they basically repeated that. Some things are different because they're actually showing live screenings in the virtual cinema now. So there, there are things happening, and you could sit next to other people and watch something. But in terms of like the New Frontiers exhibits, like they were fine. I didn't find anything particularly like super interesting. And just like last year, there's also like some that you can only see on desktop VR. So you need a powerful gaming rig, and you need like, you need to plug in your, if you have a Quest 2, you got to plug it into your computer, or you need like a full-fledged PC VR headset and go through a whole download process and stuff for that. So the experience of getting to some of these VR things isn't great. There are some I still can't access, and I've been like pinging developers and say like, hey, we would love to talk about this on Engadget. I get nothing. So, you know, user experience isn't great. But among the things I saw for Quest 2, there was one, I forget the name of it. We're going to have to look this up. But it is the one produced by the UN, which is basically like you stepping through. It's like you take on the role of a prime minister of a country somewhere. Your country is going through turmoil, and you're stepping up for a, you know, to talk, to speak at the UN. And then your, like, your stream gets hacked, and then you're surrounded by videos, feeds of kids, most like teenagers and young people saying like, hey, you really should be talking about the climate crisis and other things that are really affecting us in the next generation. I found that to be a really powerful thing to sit through, because it does like make you sit through like, hey, there's a teleprompter here. Try to read the teleprompter. Try to stay on point while you're being hacked and while these kids are like saying, hey, climate crisis is a bigger deal than whatever you're trying to say, you know, to appease the UN or the UN crowd or something. So I found that to be really cool.
Is this a piece called The State of Global Peace?
Yes, The State of Global Peace. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it seems very interesting. Like you said, like a lot of the VR projects, I have a Quest 2 just for specifically viewing some of these things, and I couldn't view all of them either, which was very disappointing. Did you watch any movies at all? Just to circle back to the New Frontier spaceship a little bit. They call it the spaceship, by the way. Did you ever like watch a movie in the faux theater?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Although that's not New Frontier, right? So they have different modes. If you go look this up, like we've written about last year, I wrote up like what this whole setup is.
Yes.
This year we covered a bit. They were actually planning to do like in person and VR, and remote stuff this year. Because of Omicron, they kind of announced at the last minute it's going to be remote only. But yeah, the virtual theater is just like this. It's a big theater you walk into, and there's a screen, there's seats.
Your
like
avatar, walks into
it. Your avatar gets to walk up. It is funny because there was kind of a bug with it. I think you were watching one of the things in the virtual theater, Sherlyn, and I was like walking around. I could see you sitting in the seat.
Yeah.
But there wasn't anything playing on the screen when I had my VR headset on, because I think you were watching, you were also in that space, but using your web browser. You were watching Cosmogony, right?
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. So people from different devices could come to these single spaces. For some reason, the video wasn't playing. When I was
maybe
in VR,
you missed a start time or something. I don't even
know. Like when I logged in with a web browser, I could see it, but it just wasn't working in VR. So, but the weird thing is, you know, I was walking around the room. I saw a blank thing on the screen. I saw people sitting down. I was like, I was just walking around. I think I may have even like walked up to the stage area and over the stage area at some point. And then I log in on the browser and people are like, hey, please keep it down in front because, you could be getting in the way of people. That was just kind of funny. Like this weird dissonance of like the reality of what we were sitting through.
It was very cute.
It was really different. It was cute.
It was really cute. It was like a SimCity theater situation to me, where like if you get too close to someone, you'll start being asked if you want to join their chat circle or something, where like automatically you can, like your microphone comes on and you can just chat like you're next to someone. Obviously, I said no to every single notification.
It is funny how like these little VR interactions are just like, oh, you're in a real space. You don't want to be too close to somebody's avatar. You don't want to just sit there and stare at somebody's avatar. Like all of a sudden, you have to have like real in-person etiquette. You know, as
you need to social distance.
Social distance, but also like, you know, you just don't want to feel awkward, right? You don't want to sit there and be staring at somebody. And, you know, somebody you actually want to talk to, you kind of want to do the like things you would do in real life. So that's always kind of funny. I haven't done like much VR socialization this year, but last year I did do like some chats with like my film critic friends and stuff. And that was fun. It's like a cool thing to have. But yeah, I just wasn't as impressed overall with like the VR stuff I could see this year.
Yeah.
Are much better.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Cosmogony a little bit just now. I'm going to quickly shout out some of the, I mean, look, Devendra and I, like, I mean, I can't speak for you, but I'm pretty sure you did this. I went through like every single project and I was like, okay, this sounds interesting, this, that. And I couldn't see more than half of them. Like, I think only check out just about half. And among them was Cosmogony, which was held in this screening area in virtual reality. But it's funny because you can also click full screen and then just view it as if it were a movie without being in the like, so-called theater, which is how I preferred it anyway. Cosmogony is an interesting thing that was basically, to me, an interpretation of space in the metaverse, as much as I hate that word. It's like a dance performance, but there are three dancers in a like a square space in a location somewhere. I don't really know where they were, in a studio.
It was like somewhere in Europe that it was being live streamed. Like their
Geneva, I think is where they said. Yeah. And then, so there's a grid on the ground. You can tell that they know their marks very well. It's just three motion capped dancers. And at first I was like this, when they first started dancing and the dancer's silhouettes are painted into like different landscapes, different environments. And they play around with the idea of like where their position is in that environment. They're jumping off of so-called cliffs or pretending to jump off of cliffs, right? So at first I was like, this is kind of hokey. But what happened was the designer and the artists on this project were able to kind of replicate the dancers. So there was not just three dancers anymore. The three of them were copy-pasted throughout the scenes. And then also in different scale and different sizes. So at some point,
they
got real big.
They got real big. Yeah.
And also had very weird skins on, by the way. And then they were interacting with the smaller versions of themselves. So it was pretty wild and mind-blowing. And at some point, they were like floating in space and like golden showers were like falling off of them.
Different kinds. You don't want that in VR, although I'm sure they exist.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. there's a rule for that. Mm-hmm. But the main takeaway for me, like as I watched it, I got very fascinated for, and I don't know that the piece was deliberately or explicitly saying this, but I think as we think about our roles and our places in this so-called metaverse, again, how you can play with the notion of your size, your identity, your scale, your space, the amount of space you take up, or are the laws of physics even the same? What are we going to do? Like, I started thinking of these questions, right? Yeah. So
when there is a movie called We Met in Virtual Reality that we'll be interviewing the director with later. Yeah. I'll talk about that in a bit, but I think that really gets across the idea that, hey, this metaverse, you can do anything. You can be anyone. I just wish some of these experiences actually showed that, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, what are the boundaries? What are the rules? And then finally, before we move on to the films, one other piece I wanted to shout out was 7 Grams. It's an AR, like a half AR-ish project that you can download as an app on your phone. And it takes you through the story of what materials and minerals are actually being used in your iPhone or Android phone. And then it kind of shows you afterwards, like how the mining process can be very exploitative and involve illegal gang types of groups, and ultimately ask you if you want to pledge, you know, to ask big tech companies to, you know, use clean supply chains or be transparent at least about their supply chains, especially when it comes to the mining of gold and other mineral materials for phones, which we use a lot of. There's a huge demand for them.
Rare earth minerals are a big deal. They're important, and there is a cost to that. So that seems like a good project. Yeah.
This is why I like Sundance, by the way, is because it just highlights, you know, it's documentaries and documentarians and filmmakers telling us what I should be paying attention to sometimes, like unearthing these like topics I would never otherwise have the time to dig deeper into. But anyway, films.
That's what Sundance is really about, you know. It is movies. About films. Like, they're just really starting to get into VR stuff.
Yeah.
But films is the big thing for them, I'd say. Yeah.
We didn't really quite agree on one of the films, Devendra.
I think one of the best films of the festival, and I'll just get into this here because I think Sherlyn is dead wrong.
Wow.
The movie is called After Yang, and it's the next film by the director Koganada. He is a really fascinating director. He did this little like indie called Columbus, which was co-starred, that movie co-starred John Cho and Haley Lou Richardson. So I'll watch anything with John Cho. And it was just like a really compelling look at a guy coming back to, maybe, I don't know if it was his hometown, but coming to a town, appreciating his architecture, dealing with the loss of his father. This movie also deals with the loss of something. It starts with a family. I think one of the like most fun and unique opening sequences we've ever seen. Like, it just kind of starts out of nowhere to be this like synchronized dance sequence, live streamed. It's like a competition with all the families. It's almost like a little Black Mirror-ish, like all the families are trying to do this thing together. But synchronized dancing, including Colin Farrell, who stars in this movie, and Jodie Turner-Smith, and the young girl who plays, who's their daughter. But also Yang, who is a humanoid android, like a fully, it's an artificial person, but he looks human, he's indistinguishable, and he kind of malfunctions after that. And the entire movie is Colin Farrell trying to fix him because his daughter loves him, and Mika has a much closer relationship with Yang, because Yang is a cultural robot. So he is meant to, like, he is a Chinese robot. He's meant to give his daughter Chinese language lessons, Chinese cultural lessons. And, you know, this is a very mixed race family too. So that idea to me was really compelling and interesting. The idea of family, and there are so many little things. This movie is ultimately about a guy and a family grieving the loss of another family member. It just so happens that family member is a robot, you know? And I found that really moving and compelling. But just the world Koganada builds here, it's sort of like a near future that has like a lot of Japanese influences, but very chill things. Like, things are very zen and meditative. Everybody's wearing like flowing futuristic robes. Their home, I love the architecture and the houses in this movie. Colin Farrell's home is like, it's a flat, like ranch style postmodern building where there's a lot of glass, but also the entire thing looks like it was furnished and designed by Muji. Just like that really nice integration of like organic and like modern stuff, like a lot of like clean wood, clean surfaces and things like that. I just love the look of it. This movie gives us self-driving cars that are just these like beautiful pods with a garden in the back, you know, like that real great mixture that you get from, I don't know, like a lot of like Japanese aesthetic, the mixture of the new and the old and natural stuff. There's like wood grain seats. Yeah. And the plants in that self-driving car. So I just found that all really compelling. I think Colin Farrell is really, really good in this. And as a vision of the future and something that's talking about the humanity of androids and, you know, of artificial beings, I found that really compelling. So I'm in the middle of a piece on this right now. I loved it, but it's kind of like it's a slow burn. It's not like a really fast-paced movie. It's a moody film. But I love that mood. I love like existing in it. What did you think, Sherlyn?
Yeah, no. So that's where you point out that it's a slow burn. And I think this is like a subjective thing. It all boils down to personal preference thing, right? For me, I am not the biggest fan of like incredibly slow burns where like it takes me, like I need to invest before I even see any real reason to be invested, I think. I enjoyed the opening sequence as well. I thought that the end scene was amazing. At the start, I really liked it. I think it was more throughout till about the first third, that point where I was like, where is this going? Like, I need things to move a little faster. I felt like, and I almost think
you got to reflect on that, Sherlyn. Like, you need it to move a little faster. Almost like we need to take time in our own lives and reflect on our own existence. Because this is a movie that is about existence. It is about what is the impact of this robot? And also, what is the value of my own life? You know?
Yes, sure. But also, that wasn't my only issue with it, right? Again, these are all personal preferences. So, like, take what I say with, like, your own tastes in mind.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
I
your
also,
personal gripes here. Yeah.
Yeah. I also, and again, very stylistically shot film. I also agree with you that the world he's built here is beautiful. There was, like, maybe one scene that was shot in the outdoors for the first third again, and that was, like, in the droid's memory.
There are a bunch of outdoor scenes, but okay.
Most of them are indoors.
There's a walk through the dark. There's a walk through a garden.
In the android's memory, yeah.
Like, there wasn't much outdoor stuff.
I felt the first third very claustrophobic. I was like, why are we constantly in... Just, like, again, a small thing. And then the other thing is I'm also very allergic to like directors or cinematographers who are very deliberate with awkward positioning and angles and framing. Not that he does that all that much here, but almost every scene in the car has a very like off angle framing. And then like there's quite a lot of scenes that are like that. And I was just like, when I start to feel like the person behind the camera is interfering too much with the scene, this is like my J school doctrine. Thanks a lot, Julio.
We gotta camp this a little more, Julio. Like, just
if you're watching this on our YouTube channel, you'll see our video team screwing with me a little bit where they're putting.
But this
my
actually,
face
this is kind
extreme.
Of it is interesting. Like that didn't bother me at all, and also this I have a feeling that maybe you haven't. I don't think you've encountered as many directors as me that try to be so like.
Oh, there
stylized.
Are a lot of them. I hate all of
but
them.
This movie is very subdued. Like it's not. It's not doing much.
There could be more.
Maybe
it could be worse. I do want to point out, like, the reason. God, the reason I am so like irritated by it. It's more about like my background, my training, as opposed to like anything really wrong with it. I think it's fine that you're like trying to take risks, but because I went to school for like broadcast journalism,
you're indoctrinated.
Yeah, they're like, no, do not interfere with the story, aka do not interfere with the camera, and do not interfere, like let the story speak for itself. It's kind of the mantra I grew up or was trained in. So anytime I see like for example, if like there's a vehicle that's like driving across a scene, for example, right? Uh-huh. If the camera pans away before the vehicle clears the frame, I also get annoyed because it's like one of the things we were taught is you have to let any moving subjects clear the scene before you move your camera. It's
you
a
know,
very,
there are a lot
like,
of artists who
thing.
Say like schools are the antithesis, like are
Damn,
the stumbling block against
you just picking
against
apart
great
everything
art.
I say now.
Yeah. But no, I hear you. I know you also had trouble with like the way Chinese language was presented in this movie. And, you know, I get it.
Mm-hmm. Right. I get that Koganado is Japanese and
he's Japanese,
I don't know,
American. Yeah.
Japanese American. And so like I can't expect him to fully know, right, what is authentic Chinese Chinese pronunciation.
The android Yang is played by Justin H. Min, who I believe is also a Chinese American actor too. So I almost wonder, like, so there are scenes where he is training the young girl in language, right, and how to speak, and I believe you were saying like his actual pronunciation wasn't great, but also that, let me tell you, from a lot of like Chinese Americans I know, the pet peeve they have is for native speakers to be like, you're saying that wrong, you know, like you're doing that wrong because
we're conflating two issues here. One, I won't go around correcting Chinese American people on their pronunciation. Why? Because I know they didn't grow up with the right environment. I tease our coworker Sam Rutherford because he did spend some time in Taiwan learning Chinese, but came back with a pretty heavy accent. But I get it. It's hard to shake, especially if you're not immersed in it. But in this situation, Yang is supposed to be an android that teaches the kid who was adopted from a place of Chinese origin about her culture, her history. The issue I had was more that her pronunciation was better than his. I was like, how did she learn from him the better pronunciation? This is inaccurate. I'm sorry, I spit a little bit when I
You're like frothing at the mouth right now.
Because I will say there was one scene where like he said something like, he points at a rainbow and says a Chinese word for rainbow, which is Tai Hong. And he said, oh, Mei Mei, which is little sister, and it's how he addresses her in the film. He goes, Mei Mei, look, Sai Hong, instead of Tai Hong. And I know it's a small gripe, but it's a big difference in Chinese. And she goes, oh, Tai Hong. And she like actually pronounces it differently and better than he does. And I, again, get that for Chinese American people, it is very like it's a pet peeve for them, or a peeve, like it is like an almost a thing you don't want them being pointed out by, like,
we don't want Sherlyn to hear us natives. Speak. Yeah, basically. Yeah.
But here it is an issue with cinema, and I encourage you to watch this video from this channel on YouTube called Accented Cinema, where like the title of the video is "When Hollywood Speaks Chinese, I Cringe." It's a really widespread problem. And it also takes you away from the film and the moments in the film. This video, like I said, the title is "When Hollywood Speaks Chinese, I Cringe." The channel is Accented Cinema. I don't have time to explain in detail why this is a problem, but that video does a pretty good job. I don't agree with every single point they raise, but the gist of it is there.
I saw that video was pulling Wayne's World 2, which is a nearly that's a 30-year-old reference at that this point.
There's a lot of recent references. Reminiscence does a very bad job randomly having
it's a very bad movie. But yeah, so basically, I think we fundamentally disagree with After Yang. I will say this is a movie people are going to be talking about for the rest of the year. Like, this is a movie that could be winning major awards at Sundance. I think it has a lot of Oscar potential. It's a movie I cannot wait to rewatch as well, just because it is one of those great things. So if you like, it is very much like Spike Jonze's Her, you know, which is a vision of the future that's kind of small and contemplative. It's not like big explosions or anything, but it's a world that is presented a little differently with technology we don't have and with a style all its own. So like, I think the clothes too, in Her, nobody wore jeans. There was no like modern clothing. It was all like weird future khakis and pastels and like a weird vibe. The vibe of this movie is really interesting, I'd say.
I agree. I think stylistically, visually, even the themes and the stories are interesting. It's just, again, the collection of these little peeves of mine made it like, for me, a difficult thing to watch. That's all. Like, yeah.
Can we move on to the movie that I think really got you in your feelings?
Because oh my
I know
gosh.
You loved it.
No, I'm going to come off as a big hater this episode. The other film I checked out so far, I've still got more to check out, of course, is a documentary called TikTok Boom. I've already written a piece about this. It's being edited right now. It should be up soon on Engadget.com. And in short, I don't know. What do you think of a documentary as supposed to be, Devendra? Is it supposed to be like basically well-researched and factual?
It can be a lot of things. It can be real research and factual. It can be like a personal, intimate story. It could just be like taking one element of a thing and trying to like dig deeper into subculture with that. Yeah. It doesn't have to explain everything. So there are a couple of ways you could do it. Yeah.
Well, part of my issue, again, small gripes here and there that like that don't take away from like the bigger thing. The small gripes are that.
I should
that,
say,
like,
this movie is directed by Shalini Kantaya. Yeah, and I believe she was known. She did a documentary
for Coded Bias. Coded Bias, and it's on Netflix.
Really well received, yeah.
Yeah. So, again, I think I might be in the minority here for, like, pointing out these things, but I do think that, like, A, there were some spelling errors throughout the film. I was just like, how do you spell censored? How do you spell censorship? It starts with a C, not an S, to begin with, but okay.
Okay.
Then there's Douyin, which is the app that preceded TikTok and still exists in China. The film shows you some experts and some creators on Douyin talking about Douyin and correctly pronouncing it, correctly spelling it, and even correctly spells it on screen most of the time. And then immediately after that, in the two frames after that, there's a couple of graphics where they spell Douyin wrong. And it's not someone else's graphic that's wrong. It's the documentary's graphic that spells it with D-U-O instead of D-O-U, which these are little things, like I said, again, they're just careless editing. Someone didn't proofread. I don't know. Bigger issue with the documentary is just that, like, it covers a lot. And some people might like that if you haven't had time to, like, sit down and read all the news about TikTok. You will
enjoy
this.
Most people have
this.
Not been fully immersed in TikTok culture right now. So
right.
It seems like there is a need to explain TikTok to people.
I'm conceding that. I agree with you on that. The film just jumps and tries to cover a lot. And TikTok's been involved in a lot of things, a lot of different debacles, a lot of different, creator entrepreneurship is one of the themes, like suicide and mental health issues are another one of the themes. And just like, there's so many things to cover, but this film does try to cover every single one of them in 90 minutes. And that's a difficult job for anyone. I feel like it would have just been a bit better if TikTok Boom were a little bit more focused. That's my main takeaway. It also makes some pretty dangerous claims about how TikTok is like scanning your face for data that feeds into its For You algorithm. There's no evidence that TikTok does that. So I don't know. I'm still kind of digging through some of this. I know that in the privacy policy, TikTok does mention it collects face prints, but probably, look, if you're scrolling
there's
your phone,
a lot. There's a lot that
yeah, there's
it
a
is
lot.
Certainly capable for it to yes. be doing this thing.
There's a lot of stupid shit in its privacy policy, but it's also, if you're scrolling your phone and an app is scanning your face, most modern OSs show you when an app is tapping your camera. You would see the indicator appear. Unless the OS is malfunctioning, the app has found a workaround. This is why I'm saying like I'm digging into it a little bit more. But like,
yeah.
I feel like that's
and context
a pretty
for
baseless
this
claim.
Too, I do want to say how much of you're not a TikTok fan, Sherlyn. You're not
I
up
don't
there.
Use
you're not with the kids who yet. Are watching TikTok.
Congrats
every day.
On being and a kid, Dev.
I mean, I have a kid, and TikTok is actually a perfect like little thing for young kids who just want to see like little loops of things over and over again, especially things around animals and you know silly little videos. TikTok, it definitely has problems, and certainly. We don't know the extent to which ByteDance is collecting data from people, and there's a lot we don't know. As a successor to Vine for that like short video format, I think it is really well done though, and the remixing,
there's a lot of great features.
Is really
yeah,
well done. Yeah.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, there's a reason why Instagram is trying to copy it. There's a reason why Facebook, everyone's trying to copy it, and it's doing so well. But then, as with every company that gets huge, then of course it becomes very dangerous. But anyway, not to say that TikTok Boom is completely without merits. Like, it's very competently shot. There's some very interesting and fascinating stories about creators on the platform and China's involvement and censorship and Trump and like, you know what I mean? Like the list goes on about what is covered, which is my point. But if you don't mind and you've never been really up to date and up to speed on what happened with TikTok, this could be a good one for you. I don't have official release information on this one yet, but I'm sure it'll be coming out somewhere more widely available eventually this year.
There was news around face tracking for TikTok. It's just, it may not be essentially what they're saying.
In their privacy policy. I spoke with Carissa Bell before I wrote my piece, and Carissa Bell is our social media reporter. And she was like, yeah, it's just, it's very vague. TikTok's never been very explicit about what they're collecting the face print and voice prints for, but they do say it's for use for, it's the face print and voice prints generated in user content. And the privacy policy defines its user content as things that are created when you're uploading stuff or
right. So
when you're,
they have
a
search
something.
Feature where you can highlight somebody's face in a video,
right,
and then look for search them. Their face in right. there, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's taking the camera and like
exactly,
you know, getting so your that, stuff unless you upload something
exactly
and they have your face data. Yeah,
exactly. So that's part of what the face print I believe is being collected for, but it's a different thing to jump from that to saying that while you're watching passively that it's also scanning your face. And look, I get that the algorithm is creepy and very accurate and it feels as if they're watching you. We went through this whole thing when we said Instagram was listening in our conversations to serve us ads that are ridiculously uncanny, but we just, it's dangerous to, basically my thing is if this documentary has said that and actually showed me evidence, I would believe them, but they just did a computer simulation, don't really show their like source and research to back that up. If they did, I'd have less of a problem with it. It's just responsible research and filmmaking, I think, in mm-hmm. in the documentary world, that's to me. But anyway, still, you
anyway.
Can watch it for yourself. Just be aware
like
that not everything is true.
We're really getting a sense of how Sherlyn rates things now. And it's exhausting to be near Sherlyn as she's watching movies, as I can attest from Avengers Endgame.
Just, I don't know. Was that exhausting?
Man.
Was Avengers
It was.
Exhausting?
Like you gripping my arm for every single time another superhero showed up.
Yeah.
It's a superhero movie, Sherlyn.
Isn't that fun?
It's Avengers.
I know. Yeah. I think everyone's different and everyone has different ways of consuming content. That's
I would love to know what you think of We Met in Virtual Reality, because I think it does actually cover a lot of things that you'd be interested in too. This is a documentary by Joe Hunting, and this guy is known for basically making documentaries about virtual reality and about VR chat in particular, which is this like cool social VR community. Think of like Second Life, but in VR, so you can make whatever avatars you want, go on adventures, hang out with your friends. And this movie kind of starts out that way. It shows like how a group of people really started hanging out together hardcore during the pandemic, but they were friends in VR even before that. And then it goes into like couples, like people formed relationships with each other. I won't spoil where it goes, but like relationships go pretty far via VR chat. And it is a really interesting exploration of how, like, I remember, and you can read this in my review over at Engadget, but I've been on the internet since like 1994 or so. So I remember like the early forms of connection, at least even in that era. I wasn't there for BBSs and like the really, really early stuff.
Oh, I love
the
80s. BBS. Yeah.
But I remember AOL chats. I remember like random CGI chats.
Microsoft Comic Chat.
Sure. Hello. Sure, whatever. There were chats for every little subculture. I made a lot of like online friends during middle school and high school, times when I should have been socializing with real people, but a lot of my friends were online people. So I had this group of people. There are people that I still talk to this day that I've met in chat rooms, people that I met in real life for the first time just a couple years ago after I met them in the 90s. So the idea of online community is nothing new, but I think what this movie shows is that it is virtual reality really takes it to another level, where you could like sit down, have like a recreated virtual drink with somebody. You could go to like an amusement park and go on some rides together because people can build these experiences in VR chat. You could go to a virtual exotic dancing club and have somebody give you a VR lap dance, which is a thing that exists. But
We've
seeing
seen
how
that before,
hard people
yeah.
go. Seeing how hard people go in this tech is really cool, because people are like, okay, I like VR, so now I need full body tracking. You know, I need VR sensors on my legs, on my hands. So not just for lap dances, but also for things like dancing lessons and stuff too. There's like, what do you call it? Belly dancing. There's a belly dancing course that actually is recreated pretty well in VR because this person invested in the sensors. There's somebody teaching sign language in VR because they have like really articulated finger tracking. So, and then people come to this class like every week to learn sign language. They're learning in VR, but they can actually, you know, show it really well too. So I found this really compelling. The reason I like talking more about the Sundance movies is because like you guys will be able to see these things eventually. I don't know what the distribution for We Met in Virtual Reality is yet, but it's going to be something you'll probably be able to see this year. So I'm sure like Netflix or a streamer will be into this. I really dig it. And stay tuned for my interview with Joe Hunting after this episode, because we go deep on like how he made it and everything. It's a lot of fun.
Gotcha. I mean, I'll check it out. I just somehow assumed that this was one of the new Frontier pieces that I needed to be strapped in to watch, but it's just a straight film. So
yeah, it's a movie.
Mm-hmm. That is pretty cool. We also have other movies on our list. I don't think we had... I don't know. Have you watched Duel yet? That one got a lot of chatter.
I did watch Duel. I watched Duel last night. Did you like it? Last night. And we could talk a little bit about that. That is the movie of Karen Gillan fighting her clone to the death, or ostensibly fighting her clone to the death. And I thought it was fine. It's a really good concept that is hampered with really, really clunky dialogue. Like, the writer and director, Riley Stern, is one of those people that writes, like, people speak like this in flat affectations.
Yeah,
and,
I don't like that.
I guess I will have to go on this duel for my life. Oh, that is hilarious. It's very robotic. It's very like flat. And if it was some people to really like reflect their character, that's one thing. If it's everybody for kind of no reason, that's another thing. I have issues with the way it ends, because I think it tries hard to surprise people, but it's actually pretty predictable in terms of like where that goes. So you could tell it's a low budget, like it is a semi sci-fi movie, because it's about a world where when you die, you can buy a clone that your family can live with instead of you. So they don't have to feel the pain of loss that much.
Yeah.
Cool concept. I wish it was executed a little better. You could tell it's like pretty low budget too. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the other film that involved robots in this year's slate of Sundance 2022 films is Brian and Charles. I haven't actually seen it yet, so we are going to have to come back to this one next week if it was, you know, good or bad.
There is more stuff to talk about. Seeing... There's Neptune Frost, which is apparently this like cyberpunk African film too. So I really want to dive into that. There's just been so much to watch. So, you know, keep an eye out. We'll have Sundance stuff coming up until next week. And, you know, I had stuff I was going to talk about here that are not tech related, but you know what? Go listen to me on the Filmcast, because I kind of mentioned all these things here. So go to thefilmcast.com on my normal movie podcast. And, you know, you'll hear me talk about all those things.
Anyhow, that was kind of just a brief chat of all the things we saw at Sundance 2022. If you want all the details, make sure to check out our coverage on Engadget.com. Right, so this week wasn't just about Sundance. I mean, the tech world had to go on. Tech news started coming out. Like, for example, Samsung shared the official date for the next Unpacked event. This is the first Unpacked of 2022, and it'll happen on February 9th at 10 a.m. Eastern. As per usual, Engadget is going to have like our live stream pre-show and post-show with question and answer sessions. So if you're, you know, interested in whatever Samsung is going to be announcing, you can come hang out with us while we watch Samsung do its thing. What are we expecting? We're expecting the next generation of Galaxy S devices. And if I can count correctly, it should be the Galaxy S22.
Samsung will have new phones?
Incredible. Gasp. Shocker. Oh, I will say kudos to Samsung. The timing this year actually seems perfect. Like last year, Unpacked was right up against CES. I had no time to rest. This time
really
around,
bad.
I feel like,
yeah.
This time around, I'm like, okay, all right. The first week of February works. We're good. Thank you. before it announced the actual date to Samsung's president, TM Rowe also published a blog post talking about what the next S series will look like. There was a lot of hyperbole as usual. There's a lot of like the most epic phone or whatever, that kind of talk. But there was also sort of hints, right, at what the next S20 or what the S22 should be like. And they use the word noteworthy a lot. And TM Rowe also directly addressed people who were like, oh, we know some of you were surprised we didn't release a Note last year. There's a lot of Note fans that are upset that there were no new Notes last year. So are we going to see a new Note? I don't think so. But what I think is going to happen is the S22 it's going to take on even more note-like features.
I mean, they're getting bigger and bigger. All they need to do is like plug in the stylus at this point, too.
Yeah, because they already support S Pen on the S21 Ultra. But that was like a standalone pen. I don't know what we'll see this year, or I can't say. It wouldn't be a surprise if the S Pen continues to be a feature, I think, in the S22, along with some other updates. And size, right? Some of the leaks we've saw so far and the renders look like the design is very similar to a Note. Does this mean, though, that the S22 will fully replace the Note? Is the Note line completely gone? Would you miss it, Devendra?
I personally don't care, but I also know it has a lot of fans. It doesn't matter, though, because their phones have gotten bigger and bigger, right? There was really no differentiation between the Note line and the typical S line, especially when, like, S Ultra started happening. So they just combine the lines. Just do it. Throw the Note people a bone. Throw in stylus support. I do wonder if, like, somebody can create a phone that gives you, like, good handwriting feel with any point object. So, like a pen without the sharp point or something, right. or like something, like just something. So you could just use anything to like jot notes down.
Like Lenovo's Active Pen, right? Lenovo did that before. Yeah. I mean, that would be interesting to see. Maybe that's the next step that Samsung should take. I will say that it sounds like maybe someone over at Samsung has been reading Engadget articles about how it's making too many damn phones. And they're like,
too many damn phones. Yeah. I also do think like there's a lot of room for companies to like explore, like, hey, just people still want to write stuff in notebooks with actual, you know, normal utensils. So one of my favorite things on Evernote is being able to just like say, boom, take a photo of that screen. It becomes like an Evernote sheet.
Yeah.
And occasionally it'll even be editable, but at the very least it is a digital thing that is saved. And if I lose the notebook, it's saved. If somebody like can really unify that experience in a phone, that could be really, really cool too. Cause I know people love taking handwritten notes, you know?
Oh, we're getting close, right? All the different pieces of the technology are there. We've got Google Lens is really good at doing like that identifying of words and converting it to digital text. You can copy and paste from picture directly now into your laptop. And then Samsung's Notes app is also worth a shout because they're doing really good indexing of your handwritten notes. So it'll actually index all of the things you write that it identifies or recognizes as words. And then when you search for your handwritten notes, you can pull them up by the words you've like written, like scrawled down. So I think that's pretty smart. And yeah, we're a few steps away from putting them all together into one comprehensive thing.
I just want to write again with like a pen or pencil too. Like I've noticed my handwriting has just gotten worse because I'm on a keyboard all day or I'm on a touchscreen all day, and like just writing something is not something I have as much time for. There is that e-ink tablet that people really Remarkable. Yeah. Remarkable too. I'm really interested in that stuff at this point. So yeah.
This is a longer conversation to have. We had another time, do kids even write anymore?
Handwriting in the digital age should be an episode, and we need to get like a really good like pen nerd.
Alex, maybe, I don't know. But no, there was other stuff that happened in tech this week. Devendra, tell us all about it.
Sure. I mean, people were abuzz when the singer, the famed musician Neil Young, basically gave Spotify an ultimatum saying that it's Joe Rogan or me. You know, Joe Rogan is out there spewing COVID-19 like vaccine misinformation and in general, not really helping society. And Neil Young basically, I think after a recent episode, was like, this is it. This is my last stand. So he said Spotify has to choose from either Young's catalog or Joe Rogan. Spotify, of course, spent a lot of money on Joe Rogan. So yesterday, after we started mulling around this news, Spotify confirmed it will be removing Neil Young's music because of that, because of that ultimatum. And this isn't a surprise. Like if you think of like clout and popularity and relevance right now, like, yeah, everybody, millions of people listen to Joe Rogan every day. Neil Young is a great singer, like a very big deal, but he is... He is important to fewer and fewer people, right? He is of a generation. He is, and I love him. I've always loved his music. I love the fact that he's had an activist streak. He's been speaking up against racism forever, too. He is like everything I'd want in like a popular musician who's using their platform for good. He's also married to Daryl Hannah, which I just learned a couple of weeks ago. So it's like,
I didn't know that either.
This dude's a king. Like, yeah, like he is the best right now. But yeah, basically, yeah, Spotify has removed his music, because he took the stand, but it also makes me wonder, like, you know, sure, I would not expect Spotify to give up on Joe Rogan because of Neil Young, but what are other artists doing? Should a company like Spotify be even kowtowing to like what their artists are demanding? I don't know. I feel like there are some speech issues there, but also what other way can you make a huge company like Spotify like actually think about the social good? It's by protesting a bit like this. Like, this is the only way you can change it, because you can't appeal to their good nature. Spotify will do whatever gets Spotify more subscribers, you know, and more relevance within the world right now. So if that means paying a ton and like basically holding your nose as Joe Rogan says what he says, they'll be totally fine with it. So, you know, I have noticed a lot of people saying, yeah, I'm just canceling Spotify right now, which is making me think, like, I think over the past decade, or at least since Spotify has been available in the US, it seemed like, yeah, I want all that music available to me. I'll pay that monthly fee. But there's Apple Music now. There's Tidal. There's Amazon Music. There are other things that don't have as good, like, playlist recommendations and stuff like that, but you know, Apple Music has really good 360 degree audio. Like, their Dolby Atmos stuff is really interesting if you have compatible headphones. Like, they also have high resolution audio. Like, there are other people doing more. Maybe they'll have like less music intelligence and less like social abilities. Like, I don't think there's playlist sharing and stuff. Mm-hmm. But you don't actually lose that much by giving up on Spotify now too. So I see a lot of people doing that. I'm considering that, because
I am thinking about it too. Spotify is just becoming like, one of the good things about Spotify was that, like, of all the devices that you were signed into, you could choose where you output your
that is the best
music.
Part it's just, that's like Spotify Connect, yeah. Boom, go there, exactly. go there. Yeah,
but it's recently been just really screwy for me. Like, their best feature is been very buggy for me, so I just, it's like less and less reason to stick around with Spotify. Also, the it's a lot of personal issues with it. But moving on, by the way, from Spotify, I don't know if you were done with Spotify, by the way, Devendra.
No, I'm good. I'm just saying, if you don't know who Neil Young is, go listen to Harvest, because that is one of the best goddamn albums ever made. So, you know, check it out. Neil Young is a king, and he will be a king forever. I'm glad, like, this is where he's using his clout and putting his reputation on the line, and I am all for it.
I also quickly wanted to shout out the anti-work subreddit fiasco that happened this week. A little bit of background. I am an avid Reddit reader. I never officially joined the NTWork subreddit, but I have always sort of just followed, and it's always recommended to me, their posts, and I'm always just kind of like reading and lurking, but I didn't officially join. So anyhow, the NTWork subreddit is sort of just a place for people who want to learn more or want to share about. Yeah,
we're all tired.
We're all so burned out and everything, especially with the pandemic making work hours insanely long. I think the anti-work movement, and by anti-work, I think this is the name of the sub. More on the update to that in a little bit. But it's not about completely not wanting to work. It's about like wanting to find some balance, and it's about it also came up after, I think it gained more traction after a lot of reporting in maybe 2020 about how more and more people were choosing to not work, more and more people were choosing to quit their jobs for something a little more sustainable for their lives and being a lot easier. Our producer Ben is pointing out that it's also about wanting humane treatment from their employers, which is very fair to ask for. And a lot of the posts that I had seen on that sub from before today and before yesterday were just about like really bad examples of bosses demanding that people show up at their whim and do whatever the hell they want for like little to no money, or not even any minimum wage at some point. So I didn't subscribe to the movement, but I like agree with a lot of what they were saying, right? So anyway, what happened this week? And I'm sorry to laugh a little bit, because this is it's sad that this happened. But what happened was one of the moderators of the Chan went on Fox and gave an interview to Jesse Waters. And basically, if you take what the sentiment on Reddit right now is basically they killed the entire sub in a matter of like seconds. The interview is easy enough for you to look. You just Google anti-work Fox News and you will see that video anywhere. And it's Doreen is the name of the moderator. They don't do a very good job of representing what anti-work is about. And I'll admit, like, I won't even do a good job of representing what anti-work is all about because there's so many facets to it. It's a very nuanced issue.
Also, you work
issue.
Way too much, too. Like, you're...
I'm definitely not anti-work. You know what I mean? Like,
we got to, like, get Sherlyn to slow down. Like, I was excited when you brought this up. It's like, oh, is Sherlyn going to take a break?
I read anti-work. Yeah. and some people might pronounce the anti-work. I pronounce the anti-work. But anyway, so Doreen goes on and Jesse basically lets them talk themselves into a pit, right? Like, Jesse, the reporter, is like, oh, so what do you do? And and Doreen, the moderator, goes, I walk dogs for a living. And they're like, oh, how many hours do you want? Like, they were asking about, like, how many hours do people of the movement want to work per week? And, like, you know, Doreen said something like, okay, we want, like, reasonable working hours. And then, so Jesse's like, so how many hours do you work? And Doreen's like, all right, I work, like, 20, 25 hours a week. Which mm-hmm. works
Which
out to about 4 to 5 hours a day.
Yeah.
Right. So it turns out that Doreen is, like, a dog walker. And that's reasonable for a dog walker. It's just that, like, it just comes off poorly, I think. But it became a whole debacle. Basically, anti-work was starting to share that, hey, we were on Fox News, and then people read it, and people just like kept over the last few days, all the reactions just got worse and worse. Setting aside some of the unnecessary discrimination against trans people that's happening, because Doreen happens to be a trans person, what happened here that was really adding fuel to an already raging dumpster fire was that the mods of, especially Doreen, I believe, refused to kind of like admit that they should have been better prepared or like they could have handled that interview a little better. And a lot of the criticism on this now is about how Doreen appeared on the interview, which I was like, y'all can stop making comments about their appearance.
There
aren't
any good faith arguments here coming from the Fox side, I would say. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't have a lot of like actual criticism against Doreen themselves. Like I'm like, yeah, you did your best in an interview.
Yeah. Maybe especially for movements like this, like maybe watch out like where you go, because not everywhere is going to be friendly to you. And a lot of people want to destroy you. And
right.
I think you see
part of my gripe with this issue, and I promise I'll wrap this up really soon, is that like, so what happened was anti-work then got it went on offline. It just got taken private, and I think the mods are sorting out what's happened, because like a lot of Redditors were calling for the mods to like apologize or never ever take an interview again, and etc. And I think the mods just weren't really admitting any wrongdoing on their part. Which is what led to eventually, I think, a lot of angry Redditors posting more and more. And so when they finally took it offline, now people are joining a new subreddit called Work Reform. And Work Reform, a lot of people are also commenting it's a better name, etc. But in the midst of all of this drama, the rest of Reddit was also brought in. And I think this is where I have my gripe, which is that, like, okay, look, I first started seeing it on anti-work, yes. But then it started popping out on our popular and our subreddit drama and our cringe and our sad cringe and like all the things that I actually follow, which is funny. But what struck me was when I finally saw on our LPT, which is Live Pro Tips. And the Live Pro Tips, it's all subtweets basically. Like everyone that's been talking about anti-work's drama has been subtweeting the issue by going into other popular subs and saying, Don't go on an interview if you're not going to comb your hair. I was no.
Also, don't. It's
that's
Fox
not
News,
a pit.
People.
Yeah.
It is
be
Fox
careful.
News. Like, be careful of where you go. I want to say, like, how much is this at all related to, like, the lay flat movement too? Like, just people just kind of giving up in a sense? Or mainly humane work? Or is it, like, people saying, like, I'm done. I'm physically and emotionally done with all this stuff.
I haven't seen any mention of lay flat in anti-work, and maybe I haven't been paying attention to the less.
It is because it does seem like
traction.
A symptom of it, of like an overwork culture just burning people out completely.
But really quickly, yeah, before we move on to another point, I just want to point out that the Life, yeah, Pro Tips post was like, I'm sorry, one point I have to defend people in the media here, because it's my job you're talking about, and they go like, media always wants to like exploit you, like it more or less like says that the media is always here to make you look bad. And I'm like, no, that's a really unfair representation of media. I think you have to, when you say media, don't label us all under the same thing.
That is what a lot of people think. Like,
it's not. We're not awful people.
It's not fair. But man, it is a shame where bad reporters, where people have an experience with bad reporters. Like, that's happened even to me and people I know, people who sat for an interview with like Business Week. By the point the article about them comes out, the quotes, yeah, are wrong. They are, yeah, misconstruing what, yeah, they're saying, and you, exactly, have very little power to like kind of change that too. So I understand
it's
the frustration.
Not all of us. Like,
yeah.
Please.
Not all of us, but people have experiences and it sucks. Like, yeah, there are bad.
I almost go out of my way to make sure like I get what my source is saying, interpret, yeah, it correctly. Yeah. Like, please, not all media, but be careful which media outlets you pick. That's what, uh-huh, I think the LPP should have been. Anyway, back to what you're saying about lay flat. You're talking, mm-hmm, about the idea that what, laying flat, just giving up, right? Like, yeah, let life wash over
you. I don't want to get anymore, and I don't want to like get up anymore, and that, right, basically was a big thing. It started like in China, right, because people were tired of working 60 to 80 hours a week with barely any breaks, and it is kind of heartbreaking like how much the pressure of work on a culture can really just, yeah, break people, I guess. Exactly. So yeah, it's all kind of related. We'll be,
it is related,
talking about some of this.
For
we'll
sure.
All try to work a little less. I don't know.
Yes, I think hard. So. I think so. Yeah. I think at least Engadget treats its employees well. I mean, y'all are always telling me to take a break. It's just me, mm-hmm, trying to kill myself. But anyhow,
yep,
that's something that happened this week. Overnight, the r/work reform has gained, what, hundreds of thousands of subscribers now. And it's only gaining momentum. And if you're interested in this at all, there's plenty of coverage out there on it. So do check it out. So now we thought we'd take a little moment to thank the people who've been sending in some nice and kind feedback and questions to our email, which is podcast@engadget.com. This week we got one from Enrique from Salvador, Brazil, who told us that they liked the show, that the last episode was one of their favorites. You know, the one about the James Webb Telescope and the Microsoft Activision story. So, hey, Enrique, we really, really appreciate the time you took to write such nice words. We're doing our best and always.
Thank you.
Yeah, dude, it was so nice. I especially appreciated that Enrique was like, oh, I love that Sherlyn and Dev are skeptical at heart because, yeah, we need to cut through the marketing bullshit. I'm paraphrasing. So yeah, it's good to know. I mean, I live for validation like this. I don't know about Devendra. So you made my
I mean, I'm glad to know somebody has at least listened to the episode and processed, right, like individual segments. So it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell, yes, if people are actually listening. Yeah,
exactly. This is like, Enrique is not someone I know in real life. You know what I mean? Like, this a person listened to our podcast? That's not my friend. That's awesome. So anyway, thank you. We appreciate it. There's more too. Ben, did you want to tell us about some of the other listener mail?
Yes. So a while ago, on the August 13th episode of the show, we had Michael, Mr. Mobile Fisher, on to talk about Samsung's new foldables, the Z Fold 3 and the Z Flip 3. And he said something about how he can't walk down the street using these foldables in New York City,
right? Right.
Without someone stopping him and saying, like, hey, like, what's that? Like, that looks really cool.
Right.
And so we were wondering, you know, are the Samsung foldables something that only appears in, you know, maybe a few cities around the world, maybe like New York and San Francisco in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And someone came into our YouTube chat and said, actually, you're not going to believe this, but I work in a post office in Alaska. So this is Kyle from Alaska. First started commenting on the YouTube chat and then sent us an email about how many people in Alaska have these big foldable phones. And it's for a couple of reasons. The first is Oil field workers make a lot of money, and they seem to like having the newest tech. And who gets the oil field workers their tech? Kyle from Alaska. Similar to or connected to the oil field issue, every Alaska resident gets a payment for the use of the land in the state. Dev, do you know anything about this?
I mean, I've heard a little bit about it, but it's $1,000?
Yeah.
It's not very big, but it's a thing people can rely on. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So Kyle says that every year Alaska residents get a $1,000 payment coming from oil money. And so everyone gets an opportunity for at least one big tech purchase. It's not earmarked for tech, but that's frequently what people end up spending it on. And so when Kyle originally sent this email, he said in the small post office, he's seen some Pixel 4s come through, some Samsung S21s come through, tons of people get earbuds, a Galaxy Watch. So it's not just the big cities.
But those aren't foldables.
No, those aren't foldables.
Those
are normal devices. Those aren't foldables, but he said that he's seen some Z Fold 3s come through as well, I believe.
Nice.
And so I caught up with Kyle just before taping this episode, asked for an update on what's happening in Alaska. The tech news coming from Alaska is that there is literally one Tesla repair vehicle for the entire state. So sometimes they'll have to drive 300 miles just to get people a spare tire. And this summer, apparently there is a big electric vehicle charging corridor coming in to connect two of the major cities in the state. So you will soon be able to drive all of your EVs in the most northern state in America. So thank you for emailing us about that and keeping us updated on the Great White North, Kyle.
Thank you for all your mail. I promise you we read them. And whenever we get a chance, we love to thank you guys on the show as well. So keep them coming. Write us at podcast@engadget.com.
Let's move on to what we've been working on. And, we're still in the middle of Sundance. We'll probably have some pieces coming out next week as well, because this is a big show. I mean, there's a lot of stuff to write about. Stay tuned for all that. I'm also going to be getting HP Spectre X360 16-inch laptop in soon. And we like the Spectre line. I like convertibles, and this is going to be a big boy convertible. So I'm really interested in seeing like how this thing goes and how it performs. Sherlyn, what are you working on?
It's pretty obvious, right, with Samsung having announced Unpacked is coming up. There's a little bit of Unpacked prep that I am working on. I'm also doing Sundance with you, Def. And then there's one thing I've been testing lately that I want to keep a surprise because I don't want other people to know yet, because I don't want other outlets to get a jump. But you will know by next week what I am talking about, and I think y'all are going to like this one. So stay tuned to Engadget.com, you know?
For sure. And we're not doing any pop culture picks this week because, hey, we just talked a lot about Sundance. Mm-hmm. But I do want to remind you all, we have an interview with Joe Hunting, the director of We Met in Virtual Reality. That'll be at the end of this episode. So stay tuned for that. And that's it, folks. Thank you so much for joining us. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Sherlyn online at...
Hey, if you share similar movie tastes with me and hate all the things that I do, you can tell me on Twitter. I'm at Sherlyn Lowe.
Yeah, I can't wait till your new podcast, Sherlyn Nitpick Pod. Just all the nits. You gotta
yes.
Pick them. You can find me online at Devendra on Twitter. I also talk about movies and TV at The Filmcast, at thefilmcast.com. We just reviewed Station 11, the entire series, and it's fantastic. So go check that out. And email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify. You know, Spotify, for now.
For now.
Now let's move on to our interview with Joe Hunting, the director of We Met in Virtual Reality, which just premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this year. You can check out my full review of this movie on the site, but overall, I really liked it. I thought it was a really compelling portrait of people who made relationships and, you know, friendships within VR Chat, which is this really cool VR social community that's been around for several years. So take a listen to our chat, and hopefully you'll be able to check out this movie soon, too. I don't believe there are any distribution deals yet, but these are the sorts of things that will end up being streamable or, you know, on video on demand or something within this year. Joe, thank you so much for joining us on the Engadget podcast. Can you introduce yourself and, you know, what you do? Because I believe it's a lot of like VR direction and VR capture at this point, right?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on. My name is Joe Hunting. I'm a director and filmmaker kind of focused on directing documentary work in VR, in social VR. And for the past 2 or 3 years now, I've been working inside VR Chat, which is a user-created social VR platform. And I've been kind of sharing stories from that world. And I've just wrapped on my first feature documentary, which is going to be premiering at Sundance, well, tomorrow at the time of this recording, which is extremely exciting moment to be in.
Definitely.
But those are a little bit about me.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you so much. I saw the film. We met in virtual reality. I thought it was really, really intriguing, Joe. And I'm wondering, like, where are you coming at VR from? You know, have you been following it since the launch of the consumer VR headsets? Do you have an interest from before? What was the big spark for, you know, following VR for you?
Well, I think I first kind of got my teeth into experiencing social VR in the summer of 2018. I'd seen VR and was aware of VR prior to that. And I've always been really excited by it because I've been a person who's engaged in online communities and I've always played games as well as growing up. So, you know, VR and entertainment and being in immersive worlds was something that was immediately natural and exciting to me. But in regards to film and, you know, getting into social VR, that was in the summer of 2018. And it was really inspired by this article I read that featured a handful of different quotes from people who were sharing how VR Chat had really affected their forms of relationships and, you know, profoundly brought them out of dark places that they were in. And this article was so inspiring to me at the time of studying and studying film and wanting to tell stories about online communities and themes around mental health and expression that I kind of immediately made my first short documentary and released it in 2019. And from there kind of fell into this inspiration and curiosity to tell more stories from the platform and have been kind of on that path for a while and decided to, you know, bring a lot of inspirations and feelings into making a feature film. And I did that and I'm very pleased that I did. It's been more, you know, the best thing, my most creatively rewarding experience making a film and shares a lot of insight into VR that I was really passionate about.
Great, great. It sounds like, I think like any good documentarian, you saw this subject and you were like, I gotta get in this. I have to explore this. That's, you know, that's really fascinating because I've talked to other documentary directors, you know, who do this for stuff in real life. But to start like to delve into virtual worlds is certainly a new and fresh thing. Do you have experience with online communities, you know, from before VR? Like, have you done Second Life or just like, you know, big chat rooms from back in the day? Because it sounds like if you were going through college just a few years ago, you're probably much, much younger than me. But the VR chat world and everything really reminds me of the chat rooms of the 90s, you know, the internet when things was kind of the Wild West. It was geeks getting together to talk about anime and Sailor Moon and video games and stuff like that. The geeks had not conquered the world as they have today, basically, because now everything is kind of geek pop culture. What is your like earliest experiences with digital communities?
I think in terms of really finding belonging in a community, it definitely came in VR chat for me. So that was the first time I'd really gotten involved in an online community. I had not been in Second Life or like Habbo Hotel, another online social platform.
Not many people were in Second Life. But yeah.
But you know, the one that I did go on was Toontown. That one, which maybe would hurt my integrity to admit that, but that was one that I played a bunch. So those I've definitely had my time in those early online platforms. But I think finding like a genuine friendship and relationship with people and really finding a community that came in VR chat. And that really came through making films and wanting to tell stories and do documentary work and photography as well. Mm-hmm. I love, you know, art and travel and meeting cultures and getting to know different people. And so VR chat really provided everything there.
The movie almost feels like you're treating VR chat like an anthropological study. You know, you're going out there, you're exploring these communities and hanging out with them. We see some emotional moments. You know, we see a wedding at one point. Not to spoil too much, but yeah, that was all really fascinating to me. But the movie also shows people going to things like amusement parks and, you know, hanging out, living their lives in VR. I feel like now that Mark Zuckerberg started talking about the metaverse and renamed his company to Meta, now everybody's talking about that. Do you feel like, you know, this is a prototype for what the vision of the metaverse is for Zuck and so many tech billionaires?
I want it to share a message and a vision for the future of VR. I hope people will take away from We Met in Virtual Reality is not for what VR is going to be, but what is existing already and what is already happening. And through that, we'll provide a truth of, you know, how to approach and the attitudes towards, the new metaverse that is being birthed in current time. So the film is much more interested in the existing communities and the relationships that are already happening, and recognizing and representing the communities that I think have really pioneered the technology and social VR. And I want to inform people who are learning about it for the first time, you know, how we've already gone through a lot of motions with social VR communities and building that out. And I think it's precious to recognize that and see what attitudes are important in terms of, you know, finding relationships, accessibility, and education as well.
Gotcha. I mean, it does, just looking at this film, and I've done a bit of VR chat stuff too, not to the extent that you have. It does feel like a proto metaverse to me. Does it feel like something, you know, is it approachable to general users? Because I feel like when the internet became mainstream was when everybody could get online, everybody could get on AIM or something and chat with their friends. Has it reached that point, or do you think like there's still work to do in terms of VR hardware and comfort and things like that?
I think there is still some steps to take in creating a social VR platform or platforms that brings VR into the mainstream. I think we've certainly not, in terms of the hardware, hit mainstream yet. That's something that I think is certainly going to come in the not so distant future. And I actually think that, you know, with Facebook's announcement with Meta and they're building their own social VR platform, I think that their platform will be really accessible for people and will be positive for so many people as well. I just think the geeks of the world and the people who want freedom of expression and self-expression, you know, and that kind of speaks to myself as well, they'll always be the people who stay in VR chat or the platforms that give full creative freedom. So I think, yeah, we've still got ways to go. VR headsets are also very expensive still in some ways with full body tracking. You know, the full gear is still very expensive and is improving. So it's early days. But just in terms of the platforms and socializing, I think there'll always be multiple platforms. I never think that there'll just be one. And I think that's fine and good. I know that I'll always stay in the creative platforms and maybe dip into those more accessible, just jump in and play, you know, like Facebook Horizons when I want to. So there's kind of just two different audiences. And, you know, and that's the same for other social medias that we already have, flat screen medias.
Yeah, I was really fascinated too to see like the differences in terms of like tech interfaces that people had for getting into VRChat. Like some people had really minute finger tracking for doing American Sign Language. Some people had full body tracking to basically be exotic dancers in VR. Do you have a sense of like how were people typically engaging? Are those like the outliers, the people that have all that gear, or are people just jumping in with like a Quest headset connected to their PC? From your experience, like how are people really getting into VRChat?
Oh, well, it's a variety. So, I mean, just to speak to just technically the platform, VRChat allows people on Quest to join, but most of the content surrounding VRChat, which is all user-generated, the worlds, the avatars, they're very high performance and they do require a PC in most situations. So actually those assets are not available to people using Quest. So the Quest experience is more limited in VRChat specifically. And when it came to shooting We Met in Virtual Reality and, you know, productions previous to that and probably my next productions, they're all in PC worlds, you know, worlds that are only accessible for people in PC VR. And so most of the subjects of the film are all experienced daily VR users who have the full body tracking and, you know, great PCs who were able to handle the worlds that we were visiting and filming in. Also, it was important to me that, you know, we could really connect with the bodies of the subjects of the film. And ASL obviously requires a lot of attention to body language and the hands as well. So an attention to detail in communication there was really important to the film's communication and story. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the subjects of the film have full body tracking, and that was something that was important to me when deciding on what stories to tell.
Gotcha. Yeah, I've done a lot of VR. I have not gone full to VR, full body tracking yet, but it's very, just seeing what people can do here is kind of intriguing.
I can happily speak to kind of as a director, because I have full body tracking myself. Mm-hmm. And I got it, you know, in the summer of 2020. And not only does it kind of just give you the ability to just move your legs and that's really fun. but just in terms of, I think, directing and filmmaking, I've never felt more present in a space than when I first had my full body tracking on. It really helped me listen wholly to the people who are in the film and anyone really, just being wholly immersed in that world and in that space, I think allows you to listen to the people you're with in such a deeper, much deeper sense than if you were just in half body VR. That's something that I experienced. Obviously, you can still communicate just fine and do sign language without full body tracking. It's not a necessary thing, but it is something I hope will be more accessible to people, because I love reading and listening to someone's body and having that, you know, as another way to communicate with someone.
Yeah, I mean, it would certainly be, I think it would be useful for Facebook stuff too. I did one of those Horizon work group things, and Zuckerberg was sitting right next to me. And if you look at the footage of that, my avatar is just doing wild, wild things with my hand.
Really? Oh, that's fantastic.
It looks like I'm having a spasm next to, you know, billionaire Zuckerberg over there. So it's hilarious. I think that tech really needs to get there for sure. Can you talk about the production of this movie? Just because it looks like it was, you know, shot with the typical camera. Mm. What VR camera tool are you using? Do you have to hold it? Can you set it up somewhere? And what mm-hmm. sort of controls do you have? Because I was surprised at like how clear the rendering looked and how good like you could capture depth of field and things like that too.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the entire production of We Met in Virtual Reality was shot using a camera called VRC Lens, which is created by a member in the community called Hirobiki. It's not a camera that's native to VRChat, so it does require some work in Unity and the game engine that VRChat runs from to really get it on your avatar and get it uploaded to the platform. But this camera was a huge motivator in wanting to shoot a feature film, because it allowed me to change lenses, you know, zoom in and out, control my aperture, change my f-stop, change my exposure. I can fly it as a drone. Yeah. Oh, that's good to know. it looks great. Yeah, the depth of field it feels so genuine and is you know, so natural that, you know, is just an incredible tool to have at my disposal. And then it, just in terms of setup, I could place it down in space and have it as, you know, a still camera and just kind of move it as a tripod, or I could shoot handheld. And shooting handheld and controlling manual focus and having, you know, full freedom there allowed me to really build on realism and use observational storytelling formats in a very raw and natural way that we see in physical production processes. And using that form of cinema to tell a story in VR has been, you know, an amazing experience, and I hope will realize, I hope it will generate some reactions of, you know, that VR is such a tangible place. I'm actually standing there behind the camera holding it and I'm looking over my camera, seeing the people I'm with, and I'm present in that space, and they see me holding the camera and understand that relationship.
You're like two Inception levels deep there too, because you're looking through a lens while you're wearing a headset. You
tell
know,
me about it.
It is. That's pretty wild.
I also had my director's notes, my shoot plan, and a clean feed of my camera, because my monitor on the camera is actually covered in zebra and peaking, and it's got all my you know, focus assist. So I had a clean feed on a smartwatch on my arm that I was watching as well. So I was deep in VR Inception. But I didn't want to look under my headset. I wanted to be fully there, fully listening to the people I was with the entire time. So yeah, it was a workflow that I built and trained myself with. It was pretty incredible. Sometimes I'd sit back and realize what I'd crafted and the kind of filmmaking I had that now exists. You know, it's an amazing position to be at the forefront of this, and that's really exciting. I'm very grateful for it.
Yeah, you're definitely in a really unique niche right here. Last question for you, Joe. This movie was, I believe it was filmed entirely over the pandemic, from what it seems like. You've also been a part of this community long before that. Did you find people leaning more on VR chat because, they're all kind of locked up, they can only do so much? Or was it as strong before? Because I also get the sense that a lot of these people are also still longing to, like, see each other in real life. You know, VR chat just seems like one step towards actually being together. So I'm wondering, is it just kind of filling like a chat room hole? Is it doing more than a chat room for people? What is your sense of this? And what were things like before the pandemic too?
Yeah. I think before the pandemic, my filmmaking felt a lot more experimental and playful. And this still was, that was still an experience that's truthful to the feature film. But I didn't really quite consider or realize the value of my own personal relationships, but the relationships that were existing in VR in general and the communities that had been built until the pandemic hit and we had that first lockdown. You know, there was a sudden sense of community, and everyone was very aware that VR was really important to us so suddenly, and we were all very grateful for that. I was filming a series at the time, we've had our first lockdown, and my relationship with everyone in that film and the crew, you know, that became my life. I ended up working on that project full time, and that was the project that I did before the feature, and was really the decision to make the feature. So yeah, the context of COVID really made me kind of drop everything and realize the full potential of being able to be immersed in a space, a virtual space, and be together in a very tangible and real way when we can't do that in the physical world. And that set a groundwork for bringing audiences outside of VR into a film about this world and kind of understand the struggles that the subjects were facing in their relationships and just in the world. You know, it was a situation that I think we can all relate to still to this day. So it was kind of an important moment that I felt I needed to capture. So it was a big motivator in doing the feature, me personally, but also just in storytelling and realizing what themes were important in that moment in time.
Gotcha. Well, you know what, Joe, thank you so much for chatting with us. Congrats on completing the film and getting it to Sundance. I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, people talking about this. I want to chat about this movie. I want to chat about VR chat with everybody else, you know.
thank you so much. This was a pleasure. I look forward to hopefully speaking again in the future. Thank you so much.